Welcome to Run Out Radio. Hello, everyone. I'm Jerry Forsythe alongside Mike Howerton. And this week we've got two great guests for you. We'll be speaking with Luke Riches, the man behind Matchroom Sport. And we'll also be talking to WPBA professional Monica Webb. But first, we're going to talk about the news of the week. We'll find out what happened in the world of billiards from Mike Howerton. Mike, what's going on?
Well, Jerry, I think the big story has to be Nils Fayen winning the $50,000 International Challenge of Champions, Mohegan Sun Casino, Uncasville, Connecticut. It's an ESPN production. Alan Hopkins puts it on. 17th running of the event. They draw 8 players, invitation only, and the big angle to it is that it's $50,000 winner-take-all. Nils won it. He ended up playing Filipino Lee Van Corteza in the finals, and with their particular format, you play a race to 5, you play a second race to 5, and if the players have split those 2 races to 5, they play 1 game, sudden death. And that's what happened in the finals, which, of course, is what they're looking for on the TV. Fayen won the lag, broke and ran the rack, nothing Corteza could do. Fayen wins $50,000, Corteza wins nothing.
Well, that's the way it goes. That winner-take-all is a brutal format.
Absolutely. I mean, I know, certainly not by name, but I know some of the players may go in and may have agreements with certain players that, hey, you know, if you beat me and I lose. But I really think that's more the players who are friends going in. I don't know of any major episodes of that $50,000 being chopped up in quite some time. Fayen wasn't done, though, after winning that event. He went on to play a Blaze Tour stop, which the Blaze Tour oftentimes draws some of the top players, but this was an amazing field for them. Nils, Ronnie Alcano, Mika Immonen, Dennis Orcolo, Jose Perica, Van Corteza, Ignacio Chavez. It seemed like everybody who was coming into town for the upcoming Turning Stone event ended up at that event. Surprisingly, the hot seat came down to Sean Wilkie, who's a regional player out on the East Coast, and Ignacio Chavez, or as he prefers to be referred to, Chavez, another one of those players not wanting his name out there. But Nils came through the one loss side and won that event. So all around, he's hitting them real good. He's looking real strong for this upcoming Turning Stone event.
Well, he's always been strong. He hasn't gotten his due. I don't know why, but it looks like this could be a great year for Nils, and I hope it is, because no one deserves it more. He's a very dedicated, hardworking guy, and it's time he had a great banner year.
Well, he's certainly picking the right time of year to do it with World Championships and the U.S. Open coming up. I have to think he's got to be a front runner for Team Europe as far as the Moscone Cup, although I suspect we won't know many of those players yet. But now's the time to peak with these big events coming up. He's already sitting at the top of the money list with that $50,000 payday. Add that to the payday that he received at Derby City earlier this year, and he's jumped out ahead of everybody else on that list.
Yeah, well, you're right. It is a great time of year. And let me go back to something you said a minute ago, because my mind's been running through it about chopping up prize money in this type of event. Really, if players do chop up those prize funds in that type of event, you certainly can't blame them for doing it. In fact, I would almost expect that to be done. These guys all know each other, and they know who they're going to be playing against before they go into these events. So why wouldn't they call one another and work out some sort of deal so that everyone's expenses get paid at least? I know that in tournament play, when you chop up the prize fund, it's called working a saver, and tournament promoters could always prevent it by not putting such a huge gap between first place and second place. But when they want to pay $25,000 to the first place winner and then $8,000 to the second place winner, because they can put on their posters that it's a $25,000 first prize, when they want to jack that first place up like that and take away from the other places down beneath first place, you've got to expect savers to be worked. In fact, it would be stupid for the players not to work savers under those circumstances that the promoters put them in.
And a lot of the players will speak out and say that it's all about the small prize funds, but there was even a lot of talk of that sort of thing going on when the IPT was tossing around the kind of numbers that they were tossing around for a while. I mean, before the bottom fell out of that tour. I mean, pool players are pool players, and this is just what they're going to do.
Yeah, and frankly, I just don't have a problem with it. It's their money. If they want to share it with other players and in return get their share of somebody else's money sometime down the road, I think they should have the right to do that. I just don't have a problem with it.
The only problem I have is when an event is being billed as $50,000 winner take all, or for example, when they have the big ring games, which seem to have declined in popularity the last year or so. They had a big one of those ring games out in Vegas in October, and the two players in the finals were discussing what the split was going to be at the table. I mean, everybody could hear the conversation, and that kind of, I mean, if you're trying to put on an event like that, that sort of thing is really for the fans to have fun and watch the ring games. So it kind of kills some of that excitement when you know that neither one of the players are going to walk away with nothing. But as far as other events, I think you're right. I don't see an issue with it.
And on the winner-take-all events, you're right. The players should have handled that in the back room, not at the table. Because it's to their advantage that the fans get the maximum pleasure out of the event. And part of that is watching one guy supposedly go home empty-handed.
Well, and the promoters have to have something to draw those fans in. I mean, you can't expect as a player for the promoter just to keep putting up money with no way for them to recoup those costs. That's a quick way to get a promoter out of the business of promotions in a hurry. In other news, Olhausen Billiards, Desert All Around Stop. All right, a little plug. Yes, it's a tour that I run. Scott Frost, big win out here. Scott has made it pretty clear to all the players in Arizona that he is the top player in Arizona. When an event has his interest, and that's a big caveat, when an event has his interest, he's almost unstoppable. Scott's biggest enemy when he plays in these events is Scott Frost. He went up 8-0 in a race to 13 finals against Mitch Ellerman, and Mitch is one of the hottest young guns in Arizona. He can't get action from anybody in this state, probably except for Scott Frost. Scott goes up 8-0 and then gets bored. He doesn't give it 100%. Maybe he just doesn't think anybody can beat him. And the next thing he knows, it's 8-7, and he turns it on again, and he wins 13-7. But Scott, I'm not really sure even he knows just how good he can play in Arizona, because while there are other great players out here, he just doesn't seem tested. People go in with the mentality that this is Scott Frost, there's nothing I can do, and generally, there isn't.
You know, my only comment is I can see how Scott could lose his focus playing people that he knows he can win over easily. He's got it right, and you've got it right. I don't see anybody in Arizona that can beat him. I don't see many people in the country that can beat him. You really got to get up into the Archer Strickland kind of category before you find people that can take on Scott Frost.
Well, especially in one pocket. Nobody wants anything to do with him unless their name is Chohan or Reyes. Other than that, he's it as far as one pocket. The other news, Melissa Little out of Colorado, WPBA player. We're all familiar with her. She put on the Colorado Junior State Championship at Wine Coop Brewery. Now, Wine Coop is one of her sponsors. The event was co-sponsored by Jacoby Q's and Brunswick. These are all people who helped support Melissa Little, and Nicole Keeney, 19-year-old girl, won the event. There's a lot to talk about here, though, behind the scenes. How many players do we know that are sponsored by companies in the billiards world, and all they feel they have to do is collect that check once a month, once a year, whatever, or the cues, or whatever, and just move on? All I have to do is make nine balls and continue getting support from my sponsors. Now, you've got Melissa, who is actively putting on junior events. She's not making any money from that event, but she's helping get her sponsors out there. She's helping take care of them, and she's also helping to take care of the junior players, which is going to be the future of our game.
Yeah, it seems like every time I turn around, Melissa Little is doing something good for the game. another player that really deserves a lot more attention.
Thought it was interesting. I was watching SportsCenter the other night, and they were talking about the Little League World Series getting started. 2.6 million players in an organized Little League system for baseball. I wonder how many players we have in our organized junior system for billiards.
I don't have a clue, but we don't have anything close to that in the amateur organizations for adult billiards. What are the numbers out there now? It seems like I think the APA has around 200,000 people. The BCA has around 60,000. ACS has around, 30, 40,000. I don't know what VNEA's numbers are. Let's give them 100,000. You're still not up to 500,000 in organized league play, even though there are 47 million people in this country that play pool.
I really think that Laura Smith and Don Hopkins are doing some good things with that junior system. They've just stepped into the reins on the Billiards Education Foundation and the Junior Nationals and that sort of thing. But, wow, we have got a ways to go. And I'm certainly not in any way saying that we should have a system in place that is as large as baseball. I mean, come on, that's the biggest thing for kids, every kid growing up. But we are just so much smaller than the other sports. I mean, how many people do you think are in organized junior systems for golf or for bowling or that sort of thing?
I think a lot more than we have. But it's because I think most people who play pool don't play pool competitively. For them, it's a social exercise. They're out to have something to do with their friends. It's purely a social networking sort of game, and there are not that many people who get excited about the game that they have to compete. Most people would rather just play pool and have a good time.
That's the whole idea of pool, that you're not playing against an opponent, you're playing against the table, and that sort of lends itself to not necessarily competing or feeling the need to compete, but instead just trying to see how well you can play.
You know, we should get someone on here in some future show from the BEF, because there's a lot that I don't know about the BEF that I would like to know. I mean, very basic stuff, like how many scholarships do they give away each year? What's the amount of the scholarship? That sort of thing. I mean, if a college education costs, what does it cost? $250,000 these days? How much does the BEF pick up of a college education for a child? What's the reward?
Well, that would be an interesting show. And then I'd also like to talk to some of the former champions at the Junior Nationals. There's Charlie and there's Sarah Rousey and players like that. Let's see if we can put that together for a future show.
Yeah, and a player who received a BEF grant. And I believe, I could really be wrong on this, but I believe that Max Eberle got a scholarship from the BEF, but I'm not sure. If we could have him on at the same show, it'd be kind of interesting.
I think Tiffany Nelson may have done the same thing, so that's definitely something to work on for a future show. That's all I've got this week.
Well then, why don't we grab the telephone here and let's dial up Luke Riches. Today we get to go across the pond on Run Out Radio. We're going to talk to Luke Riches in London. And Luke, of course, is the powerhouse behind Matchroom Sport. He's the guy who makes it all happen with the Moscone Cup and the World Championship of Pool and the World Cup of Pool and all the other pool productions they've done. We're going to talk to him about all of them. Hello, Luke. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Jerry. Good, yes.
Your next event in the world of pool is the World Cup of Pool, correct?
Indeed it is, yeah. 25th to the 30th of September in Holland.
And all of your arrangements made? Have you got all the teams named for them?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, we've got 32 teams from 31 countries. The host nation of Holland will have two teams in the event.
Curious about that. You had two teams from Holland,
yeah,
but only one team from Germany, and you have some notable German players like Suke and Homan missing from this year's event. Is there a reason?
Well, the way it works, Jerry, is that this is the second year of the event. Last year was in the UK, and there was two English teams. It's basically, you give two teams to the host nation in order to generate local interest. So everyone else gets one team. Now, the way we go about selecting teams is in Europe, because the way the EPBF operates is fairly transparent. They have a Euro tour which the players play on, and all the players play on it, and we basically use the Euro tour rankings to select the two players from each of the European countries. So the top two, at the cut-off point, the top two players for Germany on the Euro tour rankings were Oliver Ortmann and Christian Reimering. So we took those two players. And now, obviously, there are other German players. There's Thomas Engert, who won our Masters event. There's, obviously, Ralf Suke, whose name speaks for itself. And, of course, Thorsten Hohmann. But, I mean, it's one of those things, if we do it like that, then people can't really argue with it, which they do. But, I mean, that's how we do it anyway.
Luke, one other team that I noticed missing was Sweden and Marcus Chamat. Is there a reason that there's no team from Sweden this year?
Yeah, there is a reason. The reason being is that obviously Marcus is the top-ranked Swedish player on the Euro Tour, but there aren't any other Swedish players on that tour. I don't know why. It used to be quite a strong country, but if you go down their ranking list, which goes to about 500 players, the next Swedish bloke is probably in the 400s or something. So on that basis, we felt that we give the spot, you know, to a country like Austria, which wasn't in it last time. We've got two guys in the sort of top 25 and have made great strides, you know, so that's kind of how it works, really.
Can you comment on how the teams that are representing countries that are not EPBF countries, how those teams are put together?
You mean like Asia, USA, et cetera, yeah?
Right.
Okay. I mean, we choose the teams. Obviously, we try and pick the sort of, you know, the traditionally strong pool-playing nations around the world. Obviously, you know, we're a business, and our business is selling television programs. And these events, you know, are pretty expensive to put on, so we need to make sales to actually just pay for the event to happen. So we tend to, you know, if we've got a TV sale in a certain country, you know, providing that, you know, they've got a reasonable standard of players, we would put a team from that country in. I mean, that's just how the business works at the moment. I mean, it's you know, the event probably costs, I don't know, $750,000 to finance, and then we have to make that back and more in order to, you know, keep doing it.
One question I had about the way you make your teams up is, a couple of years ago, you had Rodney Morris and Earl Strickland sign a contract with Matchroom to appear in Matchroom events. This year, no Earl Strickland. Is there a story there?
Well, they didn't sign a contract to play in Matchroom events. I don't know where that actually comes from. I know where it comes from. I think Mustaney Cup last year, it was three American players who we gave them an option to play in the event in 2007, which was Earl Strickland, Rodney Morris, and Johnny Archer. But for the World Cup of Poland, we weren't contracted to take anybody. And last year the team was Earl and Rodney, and this year it's Rodney and Corey Jewell, which was, you know, our decision. And, you know, I guess they've got a pretty good chance of winning it.
So does that mean that Rodney, Johnny, and Earl will be part of the five-man team that represents the U.S. for Moscone Cup?
Yeah, it does, yes. They will. They will be there in Las Vegas in December.
You don't have other players chosen yet?
No, I mean, we work with the UPA on this, and we give them a couple of spots for their rankings. Which gives everyone a chance to get in it. So it's obviously not a closed event. If we just chose all five on our own criteria, if somebody's had a really good year, they may not get in it, which may not be particularly fair on them, which is why that system exists.
Any sneak peeks on the European team's makeup?
No, it's quite a difficult one, really, because there's a lot of players this year who've played particularly well. I mean, the team came very close last year when they drew the match finishes a tie, which is something that we won't be repeating in 2007. I think it was a bit of an experiment, and I think realistically it would have been better if, you know, once it got to 12 or whatever, then two of them had come out to decide who won the trophy. So, no, I mean, we're looking at it. We are obligated to take the number one ranked player on the Euro Tour by a certain cut-off date, and it looks likely to be Konstantin Stepanov of Russia, who's the current European number one. And the way the Euro Tour operates is that you defend points from the previous year, and I think the number of points he's defending in the next event is quite small. So any sort of reasonably high finishing will probably retain his number one ranking and get into the side.
So did you guys get a lot of flack over the 12-12 tie result last year?
I think the precedent of that is with the Ryder Cup, which the event has kind of been modelled on loosely over the years. And the Ryder Cup has always had a situation where it can be a drawn match or tied match. And we put that in, and I mean, it was one of those things that the first time we ever put it in, it was the year that obviously it then became a tied match. And I just think everybody generally felt it would have been probably better for the event if the match had been, you know, determined one way or the other at the end of it.
You know, many of the people who watch your events on television around the world probably have no idea what a massive undertaking it is to put on one of these events. Can you give me a guesstimate on any given day at the Moscone Cup or the Whirlpool Championship or any of your other events, if you include the people in the television crew and the people in the matchroom crew as well as the players, how many people are on site, involved and working every day to make these productions happen?
Well, so obviously it depends on the event. I mean, the Whirlpool Championship is the biggest event we do. Obviously, there's 128 players taking part. There's a big live television production by ESPN Star in Asia, but from Singapore. And obviously, they're probably employing 25 people on any given day working on the event. Then there's a matchroom. There's not that many of us. We're quite a small and compact company, so there's probably four of us working on that, four or five. Then obviously you've got local staff, you know, that you've got stewards, ticketing people, all that sort of thing. So I don't know, probably quite a lot, probably 50 or so. Obviously other events, the Moscone Cup's less so because it's only got 10 players in it. But similarly, it'll have a big TV crew. Sky Sports do a fairly extensive production on that particular event. And, you know, you've got just the regular event staff that you have, you know, as I say, stewards, security, you know, tickets, that sort of thing. But, yeah, they are. I mean, we work on these things all year round. And obviously we do four pool events, but we also do, you know, temping, bowling events, fishing events, snooker events. That's just the people who work on the pool. So, you know, we're quite busy all year round.
Is there room for any more pool on TV?
Well, I mean, you know, I think maybe the IPT was a bit of an object lesson to this sort of, you know, they came along and they did some, you know, the players all thought it was great and, you know, it looked good, you know, everything about it looked good. But the reality was that the economic level of pool in the world couldn't sustain something that was predicated on such high financial plateau. And, you know, we do our four events and we have our customers around the world at various TV stations. And, you know, when we did the World Cup of Pool, which is a new event for us last year, we basically discontinued one of our existing events to sort of create the space for it, which is the World Pool League. I don't know. I mean, not for us, I don't think we'd probably do more than that. Obviously, other people are welcome to, you know, come along and try and see if there's a market for it out there. But it is quite a tough market, Paul. As you know, someone like probably Kevin Trudeau probably learned this. It's not as easy as it probably first appeared to him.
Luke, one of the events that you guys run, the World Pool Masters, a couple years ago you had Allison Fisher as an invited player in it. This year you had Jasmine Ushan as an invited player. Is that experiment working out? Is this something you're planning on doing in the future, inviting some of the top females to compete with the males?
Well, probably not, to be honest, and that's no reflection on the two ladies who've played in our events. I think really, you know, at the time, you know, the event was in Holland, and Yasmin, you know, she's a good player, and she's probably, you know, potentially be the biggest player in the women's game at some point. And we just felt it might be good to put her in the event. And, you know, she enjoyed playing it. She obviously lost in the first round. But I suppose it's an experiment, but it's something, you know, we do it periodically if, you know, the right person came along, which was, we felt at the time, Alison and Yasmin were the right people at the time. But no, I mean, the first year of the Moscone Cup, we had ladies in it, two in each side. And obviously the event sort of moved on from there. But no, we've never really got involved in women's pool. I mean, they do it. They seem to have it tied up in the States, and they do a lot of women's pool in Asia as well, the World Championship. So we just tend to leave them to it.
If the market for pool is much larger in Asia than it is anywhere else in the world. Would Matchroom ever consider producing events that are targeted toward that Asian audience and don't go through the rest of the world?
We'd always consider anything like that, Sir Jerry. I mean, we've done the Whirlpool Championship there for the last 3 years, and again this year, and probably next year and beyond in Asia. There just seems to be, pool is a bigger sport there in a lot of countries there. It's fairly mainstream, which it isn't particularly in Europe or the United States. So, anything can happen. And realistically, it's all about, money. If somebody could find a backer who wanted to do, if somebody said we want to do an event out here in this hotel, which is, Europe, Asia versus, America or something, we'd certainly look at those sort of things. I mean, not that it's happened yet, but, you never can tell what can happen.
After World Cup and after the Whirlpool Championships, you, of course, have Moscone Cup, a huge event for the fans. They love to come out and celebrate in that event. What are the dates on that, and how can the American players go about getting tickets for it?
It runs from the 13th to the 16th, which is Thursday through to Sunday of December at the MGM Grand, where it's been in the United States the last couple of times out. I mean, last year, I think Jerry was there, it was an absolutely fantastic event. I mean, it had absolutely everything going for it. I mean, it had people crying, people breaking queues, laughing, people jumping into the audience. Anything you could think of, it had it. And it's not really a contrived event in any way. I mean, I think people just get really caught up in the, particularly the players, in the passion of it. People do some crazy things at that event. And, we've done pretty good there at the MGM the last two times we were there. We got some good crowds. And I think, for United States pool fans, it's something very different to what probably exists, on the staple menu of pool tournaments. And tickets for that, you can get them from the MGM Grand, or you can get them from MosconiCup.com, which is going up in a couple of weeks. And we do tickets ourselves. We do, hotel rooms, various things that people can get involved with. But it's a great event to attend. And it's one of those things where, Europe versus the USA in virtually any sport will be exciting. And if it was, tiddlywinks or something like that, it can still be really exciting because, there's just a sort of passion there for that type of event that, exists in the golf and in the pool as well. That people just, you can't match it really in anything else. Individual events like the World Championship are great, and you see a lot of things there, a lot of emotion. But in Europe versus the USA, the Moscone Cup, it goes beyond all of that, and it creates some tremendous pool.
Do we know the names of any of the European players who will be on that team as yet?
No, we don't. I mentioned previously about Stepanov from Russia, who's likely to retain his number one spot, which would automatically get him a spot on the side. But other than that, as I say, there's a lot of, it's a really tough one. It's hard to pick in Europe because there's a lot of good players. If you just say a country like Germany, you've got Altman, Enger, Homan, Suke, and that's just four of them. And, there's two decent Dutch players. There's only five in the team, so somebody's always going to be left out. But, even people like Tony Drago's, took up pool a few years ago. He's really quite established himself as one of the sort of top players in Europe over the last 3 or 4 years. So Tony's always in with a shout for that sort of thing as well. And I'm sure he'd bring something to the event. But, I'm not really sure yet. We generally wait until US Open and the Whirlpool Championship have taken place because obviously they're major events. And if somebody wins either of those events, it pretty much guarantees an entry into one of the teams.
We would be remiss in not asking this for our American audience, at least. People from throughout the world get to watch your events live. They get to watch it in Canada. They get to watch it in Mexico. But they don't get to watch it anywhere in between. Americans have never gotten to see Matchroom events live. Will that ever change?
Well, it might actually change this year because we're going to do a live webcast of the World Pool Championship this year and the Moscone Cup. So hopefully, obviously there's a few contractual things to be ironed out at broadcasters, but hopefully that will enable American pool fans to go online and watch these two events in their entirety over the internet. So that's a start. I mean, I in terms of television broadcasters, our stuff goes on Fox Net. Give it a good run, but I think for a company like that to actually take 20 or 60 hours or whatever live of these two events is probably a bit of a quantum leap at this stage of proceedings. But I think by doing a webcast, obviously, you know, we're a business. We try and make money out of it. But it does present an opportunity for people who perhaps haven't seen them to have a really good look at what they're about.
That is very good news. Very well, Luke. We really appreciate your time today, and say thanks to all the people at Matchroom Sport for us for all you do. You bring us some of the world's best pool. I look forward to seeing you in Manila and, of course, at the Moscone Cup. Until then, keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Jerry. It's my pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Luke. That was interesting, Jerry. It's always good to talk to Luke.
Yeah, he's really a great guy, and he's, for all he does, so many people don't know who Luke is because he stays in the background. But he's the fellow who makes all that stuff from Matchroom happen. If you like the Moscone Cup and the World Pool Championship, Luke Riches is your friend.
Well, and I think it was huge news in that interview that they're going to do web streaming this year. I mean, those events are so big, Moscone Cup being just an event different than any other event out there, and then the World Championships, where you've got great matches going on all over the room. I'm curious how far they're going to go with that web streaming, because they should get a lot of interest in that.
Well, I know they will in America, because it'll be the only way that we can watch the events live, since American television refuses to carry events live.
Sure. Something else that came out of that interview where he was talking about the makeup of the teams. So Konstantin Stepanov is pretty much a given on the European team, and
right.
It sounded like he wasn't sure of the others. We have these teams. We have Moscone Cup. The United States has won the event, if you really want to consider last year winning it, but they've won the event for years and years. I really wonder if it hurts the European team that they are made up of all-stars, basically, the best players in Europe, where in America, the team is made up of guys that have known each other for years. Even with Earl, and when he has a little bit of a meltdown and the team kind of rolls their eyes, they know Earl, they've been friends or acquaintances with him forever. All the players know each other. All the players can relate to what each other's going through. But on the European team, you don't have that same team every year. I kind of look at it like the USA basketball team when they went to the Olympics and didn't win. You can't always just take the best players and put them on a team together and expect them all to play at that level. But I think that's what they're expecting with the European team.
Yeah, I don't know how much that works against them or in the Americans' favor. It certainly could be one of the reasons that the Americans have just so dominated this event. And over the years, I have really, really searched for reasons that the Europeans tend to get crushed every year, although last year they did battle to a tie and they led most of the week. And I've really never found a satisfactory reason. One of the things that makes me think it might not be teamsmanship is that if you look at the Scotch doubles, the Europeans actually have a better record at that than the Americans. They win more Scotch doubles than the Americans did.
Huh. I thought that USA was notoriously good, not over the last couple of years, but I thought prior to that they excelled at the Scotch. Maybe it was the singles they excel at and the Europeans excel at the Scotch.
It's the singles that gets it for the Americans every year.
Well, I sure don't understand it. I mean, some of the lopsided results that have come out of that event, and they're not just playing scrubs from Europe. I mean, they are playing the best players from Europe. I'm just searching for what the answer is, because it just doesn't make sense based on those players and what we know of them.
We would all love to know the answer to that. It's almost like the Europeans, when they walk into the Moscone Cup arena, are jinxed.
Well, it'll certainly be another interesting event this year. We'll all find out in December if the European team can get by that jinx.
Yeah, I'm always looking forward to who's on the teams. And you always make a guess based on that, on what the final score is going to be and who's going to win. And no one seems to get real close. It's an impossible event to predict. All I can say is if you can only go to one pro event in your lifetime, go to the Moscone Cup. There's nothing else like it. It's in Las Vegas this year. Get out there.
Well, Jerry, before we move on to talking to Monica Webb, we need to pay some bills. Who sponsors the show this week?
This week, the good folks up north are taking care of us. The Canadian Nine Ball Tour, presented by Cineplex Entertainment and Chapters Indigo Bookstores. They've got 8 events this year, $10,000 added to each event. $80,000 makes them the richest tour in North America. If you're a player or a potential sponsor, contact Jim Weich or Michael Wright. You can do that through their website, CanadianNineBallTour.com. That's all one word, of course, and 9 is the numeral 9, not the word 9, and there's no hyphen, so it's just straight across, CanadianNumber9BallTour.com. Get in touch with them. Jim and Michael are great guys. You'll enjoy working with them.
Okay, Jerry. I think we've got Monica Webb on the line. Monica, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How you guys doing?
Good. I've got Jerry on the line.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Monica, I see you got another 5th place finish at the recent U.S. Open. Congratulations on that.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Looking over the brackets from this year, I see a lot of 5th place finishes. Looks like Guy Young and Xiao Ting are both thorns in your side most of the year. Is that starting to turn into a rivalry?
I don't really feel much of a rivalry with Xiao Ting. I mean, she's a great player, but I haven't got to play her a whole lot. This year, that has been the two that have been beating me. But before, I had been beating them. So it just kind of goes back and forth, you know. I think I beat Guy Young in San Diego.
Yep.
She beat me, and then I beat her. And I think we're pretty even in, you know, who's beat who. But, I'm playing well, but the year before, the last couple of years, I've been taking like 3rd almost every tournament, and now I'm taking 5th almost every tournament, and that's just the way it goes. And I'm happy with the way I'm playing, and, you know, that's all you can do is just work on your game and do your best. And, you know, the matches I've been losing could honestly have went either way. It's just a matter of who's on that day, who's breaking good, or who gets the couple of rolls that puts them over the hill, so...
Do you really think it's just a matter? I mean, you're still looking for that first win. There's the feeling out there that you may be the best player on tour who doesn't have a tournament win under your belt yet. Is it just a matter of getting a roll here or there that is what you need?
I don't think it's a feeling, Mike. I think it's a fact. I feel like a tournament winner. It's strange. You know, it's something that does kind of bother me. But in a way, it really doesn't bother me like it maybe would bother some other people, because it has come into, it's become not an issue with me, but it's definitely there, and I recognize it. You know, I took 3rd, I don't even know how many, I have the most consecutive record on tour. I have the 3rd best consistent record on tour than anybody. The
okay.
people that are in front of me is Karen and Allison, and the people that I've been... My consistency is ahead of is people that has won tournaments. And, you know, it's bothersome that I haven't won a tournament, but I feel like a tournament winner in my heart, if that makes any sense. So it doesn't bother me that bad, because I'm real comfortable with me and my game, and I know it's just a matter of time, and it's not something that I want to force happen. I think this year, to be honest with you, in January, I got a little bit depressed, and I'm not a depressive person at all. I'm always just happy and, you know, always just, you know, just the best of spirits. And this year, after the North Carolina tournament, I got depressed. I mean, I got really depressed, and I had to get over that. And now I think I'm over that, and I'm just not going to let that bother me and just keep doing what I'm doing. I went down to Florida after I got, you know, kind of down on myself, and took some lessons from Tony Crosby.
Okay.
Because I know that there was something missing in my game that was holding me back. Because there was girls coming over here fresh off the boat from Europe and Asia, winning tournaments that can't beat me. You know, that had never beaten me. And they're coming over here winning tournaments right and left, and it's like, you know, come on, Shake, come out of this. You know, it's my turn.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, it bothered me a little bit for in a brief moment. So I just went and started taking lessons to get back, you know, pumped up again. And Tony helped me just tremendously. And I see what's been missing in my game, and I just feel so much more solid now. And I don't even think about it anymore. I just know that my time is right around the corner. I feel it.
Speaking of lessons, I happened to sit next to a gentleman at a WPBA event a couple of years ago who mentioned that he had taken some lessons from you and that he was very impressed with the information that you had to share with him. Are you still available for lessons for people that are serious about their game and want to get better?
Yeah, absolutely. I give lessons a lot. I've been getting a lot of students lately, so I do it maybe twice a week. I'll do lessons, and they can just reach me on, you know, I have a lot of advertisements out there. They can reach me on my business line, which is 678-523-4272. And, yeah, I'm up for lessons.
That's great. Is anyone teaching the lessons with you?
Helena Thornfelt gives lessons as well, and I kind of learned. Helena was my coach for many years. She took me from top amateur to top pro, where I'm at today. And she is an excellent instructor, and I learned how to give lessons under her. So we both give lessons.
Speaking of Helena, I noticed that both you and her oftentimes are out competing in open regional tour events. And besides Karen, that's not something that you see as very common with the top WPBA players. Is that something you do just to try to make ends meet? Is that something that you do to keep yourself challenged? Or what's the line of thought behind that?
I'll be honest with you. I do it because I love the game. And that's something that has always bothered me, if I can just be honest, with the women's tour in general. I think we are the best tour, hands down, and we are doing great things for pool. And we are, you know, we are just on the cutting edge of bringing pool into more of a major market. But something on that level has always bothered me with female players is that they don't get into the pool room and play each other like the guys do, and they don't go and play with the men who have been, in a sense, the keepers of knowledge in our game for a long time. And I just love the game so much that, you know, I mean, I do exhibitions, I get paid, I get appearances and appearance fees and stuff like that, but some people won't go into a pool room unless they get paid. Well, you would have to pay me to keep me out of the pool room. I love the game so much. Yeah, I mean, I love the game so much. I just want to be around great players. I want to compete. And I think that Helena and I, we are probably best friends with almost all the guy players around the country, if not the world. And I really value my friendships with them, and they share the same passion for pool with me. So it's just an enjoyable experience to play with them and beat them, lose to them, whatever, you know, and just you learn. It's a learning process. I feel like the knowledge that I've obtained through the years doing that has helped me be at the top level that I am today without having maybe the fundamentals that some of the other girls have been bringing to the table. I think my knowledge overpowered them when their fundamentals was overpowering me. And that's why I went to Tony Crosby to get lessons, because, as you know, he was a snooker player from England.
Right.
Who lives in Florida now. And I was thinking, well, you know, obviously I need to, what is Karen and Allison doing that I can't do? And bottom line is, I feel like I know more than they do. I play more games than they do. So basically, it's got to be the fundamentals. So that's what I've went to go get. I've gotten those fundamentals, and I'm telling you, it's strong. And now that I have it, yeah, I just feel like a completely different person. I feel like a new page has been turned in my career just in these last few months. I'm real excited about it.
If I can go there, often when people talk about the men's professional pool game and the women's professional pool game, they'll say that the men play the game better for two reasons, and that is, one, The women lack a killer instinct, and two, the men have a much bigger break. Do you agree with those statements?
To a certain point. I think if any of you guys would come to one of the women's tournaments, you would see a killer instinct in some of these top girls that you've never seen. I mean, it's like, it's war out there. You know, it's a rivalry between, you know, Kelly Fisher, Guy Young, me, Allison, Karen, Helena. I mean, whenever these major players in the sport clash, I mean, it is just all-out war, and it's a killer instinct that I think the women have developed, and they didn't used to maybe have that much competitiveness in them, but I think that we have more developed that now in our sport. But also with the break, I think that gap is narrowing as well. Of course, it's always going to be easier for a man to muster up strength because they just have more muscle. I mean, that's common knowledge. But I think the break is a lot of timing. And if you'll see, like, Tiffany Nelson, my break, Guy Young's break, Helena's break, a lot of the top players that are actually out there working on their game, when it's, you know, in, speaking of female-wise, our breaks are almost at par with, I mean, whose break is at par with Johnny Archer or Bustamante? I mean, they're just on another planet. But I do feel like our breaks have come up to a male A player level, a professional male level. But the thing is, there's just not as many great women out there playing the game as there are men. I think the women's game has narrowed the gap between the men and women in these last few years. The difference in the men's game and the women's game, I think we have really narrowed that gap tremendously. That's something else that disappoints me, because I would love to see these girls get out there and test themselves, because I know they would just improve even more. You know, I wish they would get out there and just play in these grassroots tournaments. I mean, you know, it would be good for their sponsors, too. You know, I mean, if they're out there, you know, playing in all these tournaments, I mean, they're just, it's good for the industry and the people that is supporting them, too, you know. That, you know, wherever you, yeah, absolutely, right?
Yeah, and the WPBA does not have a problem with you playing in all the regional tours that you wish?
No, not really. Basically, what they would kind of look out for is if it's a televised event,
right,
then I need to, you know, be asking permission. And how it's advertised, you know, we don't really want people saying that it's a female professional event or something like that if it's not a WPBA mm-hmm. event. So obvious no-brainers like that. I think in the past that's something we struggled with, but we've kind of moved away from that now because there are some girls that want to play in these events like Karen and stuff, and they know it's good for us. And, you know, 8 tournaments on the Women's Pro Tour is just not enough to stay in stroke. It's as simple as that. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, it's so tough to get over that hurdle. You know, Allison and Karen, they've dominated so much. But what makes it even tougher to get over that hurdle and go ahead and start beating them on a consistent basis is you only get to play them 1 or 2 times a year. And the whole, you don't have time to get used to playing them. You don't have time to get comfortable. I would love to play Allison a 10 ahead. I would love to play Karen a 10 ahead set.
Sure.
Where I would actually have time to get comfortable and get over that, Allison, and the whole intimidation funk that they've had over a lot of the WPBA for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's when you're going to see people's real games come out. And I would love to see something like that. I would love it. You know, I start frothing at the mouth thinking of stuff like that. I really do. And I would just love to, you know, just get down and dirty with all the girls. You know, I would love, because I'm a lover of the game. I just want to test myself with them. Anybody that wants to come to Atlanta and play me, I would love to play them.
That sounds like an open challenge.
I would love to. I would love. And we just make, you know, just make an enjoyable evening of it, you know? Just some good competitive spirit and just play for like 10 hours straight. I would love it. Wake up sore the next morning and go at it again.
Monica, there's a new regime if you will, in charge of the WPBA with the new president and some new directions that they're going. As someone who's been in the WPBA for as long as you have, can you comment on those changes and what you're seeing happening there?
I think there's some great changes that's been happening. We've gotten more business people on our board. They're doing great things. We have a lot of exciting stuff in the works with the WPBA, and I'm all for it. They've brought to the table a more business insight and just brought us to another level that the players and the people, the players have been running the tour, you know, the whole history of the WPBA, and, you know, we took it this far, and now it's time to kind of see what the next level is, and I think these people can take it, take us to the next level. The WPBA, what a lot of people don't know is, you know, we have people negotiating contracts for us. We have people, you know, internationally. We have a guy that does the international works for us, Nigel, that, you know, sells WPBA production on an international level. And we're getting great response, you know. I mean, we have, you know, some of our production is playing in Middle Eastern countries, Arab countries. They're watching, you know, women's pool on Arab, you know, TV. So I think the WPBA every year grows stronger and stronger, and I think it has a lot to do with we're getting more business people, and there has been a regime change. It's kind of like, you know, the women, we have always been in control of our organization, and we grew it to the level it is today, and it's just kind of like it's your baby. It's very hard to let it go and see what, you know, let it fly, you know, see what the next step is. And, it's hard to do that. And I think we've had some growing pains because of it, but we've had some interesting things happen in recent, you know, the last couple of years with these business people on our board. And I think they've done some great things, and I think we'll see more of it.
The women get to play in the best venues, in my opinion. They play from coast to coast, and the venues that I've been in have been a lot of fun. I mean, they're casinos that are just a lot of fun. Monica, do you have a favorite tournament that you really look forward to going to every year, or a favorite venue?
Oh, I would say probably Oregon. I love Oregon because it's right on the coast. It's a smaller casino, but it's right on the coast of Oregon, and the ocean is just crashing up right off your hotel room. Every hotel room is ocean view, so you wake up with the ocean crashing right up at your balcony, and it's just such a relaxing feeling when you're there. It's in November, usually, so it's too cold to really do anything, or it's not beachy weather,
right. But
it's just beautiful. And I love Oregon. I love the big trees, and if you drive about an hour and a half from Portland just to get there, you're driving through a kind of remote country, and it's just beautiful forest, you know, atmosphere. And
Yeah. That's
something else I like doing is, you know, hiking and outdoor stuff. I love doing stuff like that. I do it any chance I get. I guess that's why Oregon is probably my favorite.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we have run out of time, and we're going to have to bring this one to a close. But Monica, thank you very, very much for your time. We hope to visit with you again often, and good luck to you on that tournament trail.
Well, I really appreciate it, and I enjoyed chatting with you guys. Call me anytime, and have me on anytime.
All right, thanks, really Monica. Good.
See you later.
All right.
Bye.
Well, it's great talking to Monica. She's, as I said, one of my favorite people on the tour. I love her spirit. I love all the energy she brings to a pool table and to life.
Jerry, something that came out of that interview that I find very interesting, no matter what level of player you are, Monica is top five WPBA players. There's probably hundreds of women who try to make it onto that tour, and then of the players who do make it onto that tour, so many of them don't excel to the level that she has achieved. But no matter how well you play, there's always something that can be learned by going out there and spending quality time with an instructor.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. The instructors I've gone to have always had great lessons for me, things that I had never even considered, and they're cool, which is great because they will look at your game and tell you what you're doing wrong, and your friends won't do that.
I spent some time with an instructor out here in Arizona, Don Rose, been a part of the game for years and years. It was interesting. He was on the other side of the room. I walked in. I was hitting some balls. He walked over and said, "You're Mike?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, we'll go ahead and keep hitting the balls." And I thought, I'm paying this guy for me to hit balls around on this table. That's interesting. And he walked over about 15 minutes later and set up a shot and said, "Okay, here's your shot. Here's your next ball, and this is the ball you're trying to get shape on. Go ahead." I said, "I can't get shape on that ball." And he said, "I know. You will be able to by the time this hour is up." It was just amazing how he could look across the room and see something that you would never see, because you're concentrating so much on that cue ball and the object ball, you don't see everything that goes on behind it. But an instructor does, and they know what they're looking at.
Yeah, you know, I had much the same experiences with both Randy Gottlicker in Dallas and Nick Varner. And I've taken lessons from both of them. Randy, I was really amazed at, because while Randy is a fine player in his own right, he's certainly no pro. The analogy that I was given was Vince Lombardi could never throw a pass, but he could certainly teach someone how to do it. And that's what I found with Randy. He could analyze just the minutest details of your game and tell you ways to do it better. When I went to see Nick, I was in a slump, and I could not get my game together, and I didn't know what I was doing wrong. I went through all the basics again and just could not find the clue to get my game back. And he watched me for about 5 minutes and came up and said, "Your bridge is too far away from the cue ball. Move it in about 4 inches." And sure enough, I moved my bridge hand in and my game came right back. I mean, in 3 or 4 minutes, it was back. I just, over the course of years, had been sliding my bridge hand back. And from watching the Filipino players, by the way, because their bridge hands are all 18 inches to 2 feet away, it seems like, from the cue ball. So I thought, well, that's the way you're supposed to do it. No, that's the way you do it if you're good enough to do it that way. Me, I got to have my bridge hand a lot closer to the cue ball.
It's interesting that you mentioned Nick Varner. I'm not familiar. I never met the gentleman, but the word going around for a while is that the late Hal Mix had been a coach for Nick Varner. So, I mean, even Nick, who's won championships in every game out there, still had someone that he spoke to about improving his game.
Oh, yeah. Nick has taken advice from quite a few people over the years, and he's not at all ashamed to give them credit.
Well, Jerry, that pretty much wraps up our show this week. Looking forward to next week. We'll have the Turning Stone event to talk about, as well as a number of regional tour stops going on.